You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 15th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And on this date, September 18th, 1895, Daniel David Palmer gave the first chiropractic adjustment to Harvey Lilliard in Davenport, Iowa, which is now the home of Palmer Chiropractic College.
Now, he gave an adjustment to a guy that was having hearing problems, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And claimed that he cured him of his deafness.
What was that?
Right.
Stop being such a pain in the neck, Jay.
Wow,
the first chiropractic adjustment in history. I mean, that's something.
That's something, all right. So, Jay, tell us about modern believers in geocentrism.
We're dealing with a bout of the old geocentrism again. I'm sure you all know what it is, right?
Well, geo means earth, centrism means center, so...
So it means you love George Rabb's podcast.
Real briefly, geocentrism is the belief that the Earth is fixed in space and the entire universe revolves around it.
So that's how it seems.
This puts the Earth in the center of the universe. Yeah, you know, you could totally get it back in ancient times. Sure. Of course people would make observations and think that. So it does date back to ancient Greece and ancient China. And as an example, both Aristotle and Ptolemy believed it. But even at that time, other philosophers did not believe in it. There were other theories going on at the same time. Modern geocentrism, on the other hand, is mostly based on the Bible. And
yeah,
there are many passages that make reference to the earth and the position of the earth and all that. So the reason why we're talking about this is because a lot of skeptics have sent us emails, and Phil Plait did a phenomenally good blog on the fact that there is a conference in Indiana this November called Galileo Was Wrong, The Church Was Right.
Huh. Nah, 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 nah.
I read about this topic. It's really interesting. I mean, geocentrism is actually pretty cool. The idea of it is cool, and I learned some things that I didn't actually know while doing the research for this. So geocentrism, as I said, is a frame of reference with the Earth at its center, and then heliocentrism, helio meaning the sun, is a frame of reference with the sun at its center. And you could keep going out from there. So you could say like galactocentrism, which is the Milky Way being at the center of or frame of reference, right? So you could just keep going out. But there actually isn't like a center to all things. You're just using these as frames of reference to predict things or to, you know, figure out the way that bodies are going to interact with each other. Okay, so according to relativity, any frame of reference can be correct. And in fact, no one frame of reference can be the only one that is correct. They all are correct, according to the theory of relativity.
Yeah, that's the core right there. All frames of reference are equally valid.
I think a key aspect there, Steve, is that the uniform motion, though.
Yeah, right.
So getting back to geocentrism, there are two kinds of geocentrists. The first kind use relativity to say that they are right because relativity says so. The problem with this logic is that relativity also says all other frames of reference are right too, so they're conveniently cherry-picking the parts of relativity that add to what they believe. The second kind of geocentrist believes that relativity is wrong, completely wrong. And Phil puts this very well in his blog on this topic. In short, Phil said that relativity is so incredibly proven, so overwhelmingly tested and factual, that you could be nothing but a kook if you deny it.
Right. Like that's a lot of right. things, like evolution, you know.
So science has so substantially proven that geocentrism is wrong because of the stunning evidence that proves otherwise. And this leaves geocentrists with one final thing in their corner. And that happens to be the Bible. Oh, yeah. The problem is that their conference is using science intensely cherry-picked for their pleasure to back up their claims.
Yeah, that is the problem.
And the other thing point out is that they're not just saying that the Earth is a valid frame of reference for certain things, which it certainly is. You know, if you want to describe your movement around the Earth, it's perfectly reasonable to describe that with the Earth as an Earth-centered frame of reference. They're saying that it's the actual physical center of the universe, and that is the best way to understand, you know, how the universe is organized, and that is not valid. It, it, and it, you'd have to go through a lot of complicated shenanigans in order to even make observations work out.
Right.
With that,
could you imagine if Neptune had to go around, you know, go around us, you know, once a day to have it be in the similar position, you know, in the sky? It would have to travel faster than the speed of light.
Well, how do they deal with retrograde motion of the planets? Do they resort to epicycles and things like that?
Yes, you have to get they basically argue that the math can work out, which is true. It just gets horrifically complicated. But Evan, I thought that as well, that even for anything, you know, Neptune and farther, that if you do with an Earth-centered universe, I mean, especially the stars, right, or other galaxies, they would have to be traveling at faster than the speed of light.
So what?
In order to go around the Earth. Yeah, but Phil makes the point, though, that that's actually not impossible using a coordinate system. And I'm not sure I fully understand it, but that basically that does not violate relativity. In the way the relative motions work, right? It still is silly to think that the entire universe is traveling around us in one day. I mean, no matter how far away they are.
Yeah, I mean, but you have to. It seems like you have to put a whole set of special new laws of physics into play to explain in order to accept geocentrism.
Right.
Now
that we know that the stars are not embedded in some kind of layer that's not that far from the Earth, right, which is what people thought.
Yeah, they were saying it was like a substrate, that things were embedded in like this ethereal substrate.
The firmament?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, they basically thought the planets, you know, everything in the heavens, they were not that far away, and the fixed stars were fixed in some kind of a layer. But not that they were all suns, billions and trillions plus miles away, right? They just had no concept of that. So, I mean, the notion of geocentrism becomes more and more absurd as we learned more about the actual structure of the universe.
I'm still not convinced that the whole geocentrism thing isn't just one big satire. Am I the only one who feels this way? Because otherwise I have to accept that humans are so stupid.
And you haven't accepted that yet?
I guess that at heart I'm an optimist, and I prefer to believe that people wouldn't go to such incredible lengths to justify an irrational belief. I mean,
You're underestimating the intellectual laziness of the human species.
Oh, but it's not intellectual. I don't think it's intellectual laziness at all. I think it's...
takes a lot of work to be that much of a
crank. It's more effort. Yeah, it takes more effort to, you know, to start with a stupid belief and then, you know, find bits and pieces of things that will support that belief and to bend over backwards to support it.
But it's...
You know, against all evidence to the contrary.
But Rebecca...
You know, you're just wrong.
You know, this... I know what you're saying, but we're not just talking about a stupid belief. I mean, this is their entire world view that would be totally and utterly destroyed if they didn't believe these wacky things. So, and you know, just knowing human psychology and how people believe that, to me, it's like, yeah,
but Bob, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that because you could still believe in the Bible and not believe in that.
I know you can, but their world view was wrapped around their literal interpretation.
This is a worldview, even more than creationism, evolution, quote-unquote, debate. This is a worldview that was so utterly debunked thousands of years before these people were even born. I guess that's what is ultimately what makes me so incredulous about the entire thing and a bit depressed.
But that is the default mode of human behavior, is to pick a belief and then defend it and cherry pick the evidence to support it and use confirmation bias, etc. This is just that taken to an extreme degree.
Right. This is the far end of the bell curve right here.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's nobody who believes this for scientific reasons, right? The only modern adherents to geocentrism do so for reasons of ideology. Speaking of which, there's another news item that is a similar intrusion of ideology onto science, this one having to deal with the Irish Minister of Science.
That's right. The Irish Minister of Science is Conor Lenihan, and he apparently is friends with a constituent named John J. May, who wrote a creationist book.
He's also the leader of the V Resistance, by the way.
What's the V? You mean
awesome.
Like the... The anonymous thing?
That TV show from 1985.
V for Vendetta?
No. V, Visitors. John May Lives.
Yeah.
John May is the leader of the V Resistance.
You're talking nerd talk right now, aren't you?
Yep, just go on.
Yes. Rebecca, it's a nerd podcast. What the hell?
Ignore it.
Guys, how many years has it been? She still doesn't get it. Rebecca, you are on a nerd-based podcast.
I'm sorry. No, let me be clear. You're using old nerd talk, aren't you?
No, this is recent.
Thank you.
This is recent?
This is the new version of V.
There's a new version of V?
Yeah.
Is that with like the aliens with the spots on their heads?
No, that was Alienation.
Alienation.
Yeah, that was old.
No, this is a remake of V that ran one season this spring.
Yep. It's not too bad. It's not too bad. I saw a bunch of episodes.
Yeah.
Were there any zombies in it?
No.
Oh, that would have been Z Resistance.
Hey, yeah, sorry. So anyway, the Irish Minister of State. So this real, actual, living, non-fictional person, John J. May, a creationist book.
Not nearly as interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, well,
I wish it was fiction.
It's called The Origin of Specious Nonsense, which
how clever.
Sounds actually appropriately titled when you think about it. In fact, he refers to evolution as being some made-up myth thing because he doesn't understand evolution, and that's enough for him. So, apparently, it's a big load of nonsense, but he was having a book launch and he invited this Irish Minister of Science to come along. And so he was going to attend, and the internet found out, like PZ Myers.
The internet.
You don't want the internet to find out things like this.
That's like the Borg finding out.
Yeah,
right?
Basically.
Reddit. Rebecca, how cool is PZ Myers right now? Rebecca said, the internet found out, and the very next thing out of her mouth was PZ Myers sitting on top of the internet.
Roar. Right, riding the internet.
PZ Myers of the internet.
Yes. Well, they attacked, basically, and flooded Connor Linehan with emails, and I think they also complained to the government at large in Ireland, and Linehan ended up being disinvited from the book launch. Apparently the author didn't want him there because of mean things being written on the internet, and I'm sure that Linehan himself just realized that it was a poor move on his part and pulled out. But I don't think he's issued any sort of clarification on his views on creationism or anything like that. For all we know, the Irish Minister of State with special responsibility for science, technology, innovation, and natural resources actually doesn't know anything at all about science. He doesn't have any scientific qualifications, apparently. Isn't necessary, I guess, to take on responsibilities like these, unfortunately.
But this happens so often in governments all over the world. You put these nincompoops into these positions in which scientists really should be in charge, yet you get these otherwise incompetent people, and it really screws things up.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen the same thing happen in Texas with an elected school board making decisions that, affect school children based on and they're just using their own stupidity and prejudices to make scientific decisions.
Although in Ireland, apparently these are not elected positions, they're appointed. And some of our when I blogged about this also, some of the comments from people from Ireland were saying that this is very common, that people get appointed for political reasons, so they generally don't have any expertise in the position that they're put in, whether it's science or something else.
He just managed to be friends with the right person.
Yeah,
yep.
Right, exactly.
It's who you know, not what you know.
Mm. Now, Linehan did say, he is quoted in the Irish Times as saying that he remains to be convinced by Mr. May's arguments, which is sort of a soft way to distance himself from it, and also that he wanted to attend the launch in his personal capacity, as if he could separate that from his capacity as the Irish Minister of Science. Because he believed in a diversity of opinion is a good thing.
Oh, I love
there
that.
We go. Oh, my gosh. We've heard that also before so many times.
Like, to all the politicians who happen to be listening out there, you can't separate your personal opinions because, when you're hired to do a job, your opinions about the things related directly to that job matter. So yeah, your opinions on science and evolution and creationism, they're gonna come into play if you're the minister of science.
Have you guys taken a look at John May's book or website?
Not at all.
Yeah, this guy is the living embodiment of the arrogance of ignorance, of the the Dunning-Kruger effect. Are you guys familiar with that?
No.
Yeah, the dumber you are, the smarter you think you are. Is that
exactly
what it was?
Exactly. Yeah. The less able you are to assess your own stupidity.
Yeah, you know, I went to his website and it had music automatically playing. So, I mean, that told me everything. I turned it around.
So, yeah, I mean, he's intellectually, the guy's just a jackass. He's, you know, has some YouTube videos. He's pontificating. And basically his point is that the human body's really complicated. Gee whiz, isn't it awfully complicated? That's about all he has.
That's enough for me, yeah. I think.
Too complicated for me, therefore.
Can't argue with that.
Right. But what? But and then?
And God, and scientists don't know what they're talking about. They're lying and it's all BS.
Yeah. And right. Then?
That's it. Okay. He goes on to the next point. And then they say
the skull is
skull is 4 million years old. That's BS. Okay.
All righty.
That's your argument, that it's BS? They're just making it up. No, actually, they have dating methods. Yeah, you know, doesn't it actually address the evidence or any of the arguments, just dismisses it out of his own ignorance. Well, Bob, let's shift gears a little bit. Tell us about this new robot skin.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about robot skin lately. What do you guys think when I say robots from science fiction? You think C-3PO,
danger,
Robbie, the robot?
No, I think the sex slaves from Westworld.
No, you can't think of that because that ruins my point.
Cherry 2000?
Cherry 2000.
Now, the idea is that science fiction robots are often shown with a hard metallic body, right? It's practically an iconic image.
No, they're not.
What?
Cyborgs, man. What are you talking about? Androids. Jay,
just go with it, Jay.
I'm not making it easy for you, Bob.
Just,
right?
We're just roll with
talking
this
about
board.
Robots.
Just roll with this, Jay. So, but if you think about it, that's kind of silly, right? I mean, imagine navigating and interacting with your environment without a sense of touch. Now, that's not impossible, but it seems very limiting to me, not to mention also probably dangerous. Actually, the same is true even today for most modern day prosthetic limbs. There's little or no feedback to help you determine how tightly something needs to be held. But, you know, of course, the cutting edge in the R&D prosthetics, they've had tactile feedback for quite a while now. But up to now, they've been made with organic materials, which haven't been sensitive, and they require a lot of power. And a lot of power means big and heavy batteries, right, which, of course, is a no-no for something that's got to be portable like a prosthetic limb or a robot. So now, back to the news item, now it seems that two groups of researchers have independently come up with this low-power, incredibly sensitive fake skin, or e-skin, as they call it. You got to throw that E in front of everything. That could one day cover entire prosthetic limbs or robot bodies. Two teams came up with the similar ideas. I mean, not only did they kind of address this very, very similar problem, but their ideas were very similar as well. And I don't think there was any interaction between these research teams either. One team is from the University of California at Berkeley. The other team is from Stanford. Now, they each used a special kind of pressure-sensitive rubber that changes its electrical properties depending on how it moves. And in conjunction with this special rubber, they use this kind of like a matrix of transistors that can sense this change. So what they essentially have, both these teams, are these arrays of pressure sensors that are very good at converting pressure changes into electrical signals. So that's kind of what they made here.
That's awesome. That makes
fundamental
total
level.
Sense.
Yeah.
But how does it feel?
Right. We won't know until they could hook it up to the brain. But these actually are so good. This e-skin is so good that in a couple of characteristics, it's comparable to human skin. And one of these characteristics it's as sensitive. It's actually as sensitive as human skin in terms of detecting minute amounts of pressure, and they can detect that change just as fast as human skin, which is pretty impressive. I believe these two devices are this two bits of technology are about twice as good as the next best e-skin that's ever been made. But there's one characteristic though that it doesn't match. Can you guys guess what characteristic of the skin that it doesn't match?
2-point discrimination.
It causes cancer when you touch it.
Yeah, Steve. That's it. Spatial resolution. So, or basically, how close can two things be on your skin and still feel like two separate things, basically? So, you know, the gold standard for this is the ability of the skin to distinguish between two separate pinpricks, right? This is called the sight threshold distance.
So you could do this to yourself, right? Like you take two pins and you hold them like 3 inches apart and you feel it as two separate things and you bring them a little closer.
Right.
There's a point where you can't distinguish between the one or the two.
And if you hit the right point, you'll cure your cancer.
And you're giving yourself a acupuncture cure at the same time.
And that varies based upon where you are on your body, right? So your fingers have the finest 2-point discrimination. The back of your neck, not so much.
Yeah, for fingers, for our fingers, it's about 2 to 3 millimeters, which is pretty much the finest resolution we have on our bodies. And then it goes up, like your upper lip is 5 millimeters, your nose is 7 millimeters, your foot is 20 millimeters. What do you think the worst is, or at least the worst that I've found in
your
my
ass.
Research? let's see. Let me look at my list.
No,
ass
definitely
is not
the taint.
On my list.
Your back.
Back. I'd say lower back.
Back is 39 millimeters. That's very far up the scale. Shoulder is 41. Your thigh is 42. And the worst on my list anyway is your calf at 45 millimeters. So,
oh, that's weird.
So if you put two
pins.
For
some people, a cankle.
Yeah. Oh, God. For a little extra biology thrown in there, humans have such fine discrimination because of the Meissner corpuscles.
Now you're making shit up.
I know, Bob. Come on, really?
No, these are called Meissner's corpuscles or tactile corpuscles. And they're basically, you know, they're in your skin everywhere. And it's basically just a type of nerve ending that gives us our sensitivity to a light touch. Now, comparing this to the prototypes that I've been talking about, the Stanford prototype has the pixel or the smallest unit of the pressure sensor is 8 millimeters, which isn't too bad. The Berkeley one is 3.5 millimeters to a side. So that's actually not too bad either. And of course, this is only going to improve. I mean, I could see, you know, it probably won't be too long before they have sub-millimeter resolution, which, or even much, much better than that eventually. But there's other hurdles as well. They've got to figure out how to make large pieces of this e-skin work reliably and inexpensively. And they also need, more importantly, I think, is to integrate the e-skin with computer chips to interpret the signals that are coming from the transistors. And then after that, once they get that down, I think one of the first ways we'll see this technology is maybe surprisingly in the coatings for laparoscopic tools for surgeons. So they could actually kind of feel their way, in a sense, through the body as their tools are moving through the body. So they're not like bumping into tissue and damaging it. And then longer term, I think we'll finally see this e-skin used in prosthetic limbs. In this case, the researchers anticipate interfacing the e-skin, not with a computer chip, but with the brain itself. So then, if you get your hand lopped off by a lightsaber, you can get your very own Luke Skywalker hand.
Yeah.
Wow. Really?
Well,
oh, yeah.
There are some other technological hurdles in there as well, but this one.
Yeah.
Just
a few.
The skin will help them. One step closer to the robot uprising.
Yes, my robot master.
The porn industry will use it first.
Yeah, probably.
They do set the standards on lots of things.
There's a quick update on the whole vaccine autism thing. There was a study published in the journal Pediatrics, a study performed by the CDC. This is actually the follow-up to one that was presented in 2007. The 2007 study, they looked at any correlation between exposure to thimerosal and about 40 or so different neurological outcomes, and they found that basically there was no pattern of any increased risk from thimerosal. There were a couple things that were a little bit increased risk, a couple that were actually decreased risk. And also, you know, if you do you adjust the statistics for multiple comparisons, they weren't statistically significant. So essentially that was a negative study. Now this is the follow-up to that. We've sort of been waiting for this for the last 3 years, where they look specifically at autism, which was not included in the prior study. And no surprise, they found no correlation between thimerosal dose and the risk of developing either autism specifically or autism spectrum disorder or regressive autism. So yet more evidence for lack of a correlation between dimerosal, which is, you know, the mercury-based preservative in some vaccines, and autism or autism spectrum disorder. Although I always hasten to point out that in the U.S., dimerosal has basically been removed from childhood vaccines. It's only present in negligible trace amounts in a couple of vaccines and in some versions of the flu vaccine, which is optional. It's not part of the standard vaccine schedule.
And also you would get more mercury by a normal diet than you would by the vaccine anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you get more mercury from eating a tuna fish sandwich.
So, Steve, by the removal of the thimerosal in the vaccines over all these years, does that just mean the vaccine has now a shorter shelf life and it has to be used faster?
No, what it means is you get single-dose vaccines and no multi-dose vaccines. So that's what it practically meant, which is not a big deal in industrialized countries. It is a big deal in the third world where they can't afford single-dose vaccines.
I mean, that's all great and all, but I wish we had evidence like that, 5, 6, 7 years ago, because now it just seems like, yeah, that's great, but everybody's
put it in the pile.
Everybody's moved past the whole thimerosal thing anyway. The believers and the non-believers, everybody. So this is like, it's nice, but
now the believers haven't abandoned the thimerosal or mercury hypothesis. They just don't talk about it when the evidence is like so overwhelming.
They're the geocentrists of the medical.
They basically, basically they are. I mean, they get all coy and they'll say, well, we're not saying it's, there could be other ingredients in vaccines, but they never ever admit, okay, it's not thimerosal or thimerosal
really?
Has been cleared.
Okay.
They will never say that.
Maybe one or two.
They try to have it both ways.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I mean, again, their ideology is anti-vaccine. So it's, they take everything that they can get to as an argument against vaccines. They're not interested in the actual evidence. This isn't going to change anyone's minds. Yeah. And they're already writing this off as, it's a government-funded CDC, put up job. It's all a hoax. It's fake. It's just a big part of the conspiracy, right? So, and of course, I had to earn my big pharma paycheck by talking about it on the show this week.
All right.
Cha-ching.
Evan, tell us why the Canadian government wants to muzzle scientists.
Yeah, because they're a bunch of Orwellian fascists that...
The scientists?
Want. No, not the scientists. The government.
Oh.
Get his check back.
We have what we have happening in Canada, and according to an article that came out in the Vancouver Sun this week, federal researchers or scientists of government whose work is financed by taxpayers must now receive approval from government bureaucrats before speaking or presenting their data to the media.
Yeah.
So what does this mean?
Well, what it means is that, for example, they took, for example, in this article that there was a research going on with floods that occurred in Canada some 13,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age. And the government bureaucrats in the capital of Ottawa deemed that the scientists were not allowed to talk about it, not allowed to release the data, not allowed to speak to the media about it until they got all kinds of level of pre-approval from various or
from the Ministry of Information,
from the Ministry of Information, from other levels of government before they could even go forward with talking to them at all about anything that they learned. That the scientists learned through this research. Apparently, the rules were put in place to deal with more politically sensitive issues, such as global warming, for example. But this particular study that they cited, and they were looking for to get information out on, it really has nothing to do. There's like nothing political at stake here. At least not that they could deem. Regardless of that, the bureaucrats still had to give approval before any kind of information was passed along to the media. Doesn't matter. So what we have happening in Canada is that Big Brother is putting a muzzle on scientists, especially and government paid scientists. These are tax funded. These are the taxes that the people pay for. To have this research done, and they're not allowed access freely to the information.
Yeah, you could argue that the public owns that information, right? The government
absolutely
shouldn't control it. they must justify this by saying that they don't want to, what, confuse the public or have some rogue scientist saying nonsense to the public as if it were official. That all they have to do to achieve that is just, you know, not allow scientists to make official statements on behalf of any government organization or body unless it's, you know, been vetted by that body and it is official, right? And even if there were any benefits to it, which I don't see, it's just not worth it. It's not worth the downside, which is restricting the free flow of information, especially information that the public paid for. Have you guys seen this crop circle sting video?
Oh, yeah, man.
How bad was that? Yes.
I don't think Sting was involved.
No, Sting was not involved, but it was a great sting. I don't know if this was on purpose.
It was not, in fact. What happened was
the woman stung herself.
And basically there's a channel in Norway, which translates, I think, just to channel five. And apparently, according to our Norwegian skeptical friends, they show a lot of crappy psychic shows, I don't want to speak poorly.
Same as America.
Yeah. I don't want anyone to think this is just something different. They play a lot of credulous programs. But they had a documentary crew following around this so-called psychic. So they came to England and they found out that there was a fresh crop circle not too far from where they were. And so they decided to go check it out. And the documentary crew shows them going to the crop circle, and the psychic is getting kind of overwhelmed with all the energy she's feeling, and she takes a bit of the crops home with her, you know, as a souvenir, and she talks about how, yeah, her whole life is going to change from because she's interacted with this crop circle, and she can really feel the energy. And they show her a picture of the crop circle from, an aerial photo. And she goes, her companion first says, oh, it's a man in a circle. And the psychic says, they look at it more and they're like, no, it's a magnifying glass. It looks like a magnifying glass with a man inside. And they show it on the documentary, and it's a magnifying glass, not with a person inside, but with a lowercase I. And this sort of goes to air. They don't really mention anything more about what it could be. At least that's where the clip ends online that I saw. These skeptics immediately got a clip of this and put it online for the world to enjoy, because those of us who live in England, certainly, and I know a lot of Americans are fans as well, know that that symbol, the lowercase I in a magnifying glass, is actually a logo for Stephen Fry's extremely popular panel show, QI.
So the aliens are fans of QI as well?
Apparently.
They're smarter than I thought.
Yeah, they're very, very bright aliens. And it's funny because Stephen Fry is a skeptic. He's going to be at TAM London this year, actually. Woo-hoo. Tickets still on sale, by the way. But yeah, so I think he's really going to get a kick out of this. So it wasn't a sting. It was just a psychic making a boneheaded move and the network not realizing what they had walked into.
Right, what they stumbled into.
Yeah.
And I also love the way at one point they're pointing out like how interlaced the stalks are. Like how precisely. And then
various layers.
Yeah, the different layers, and they find the epicenter with a little circle in the middle, and they're marveling at these little details, which of course is again a perfect example of anomaly hunting. They're just looking for things that look interesting to them, and to them that's evidence of aliens.
And the QI producers couldn't have hoped for better viral marketing.
It doesn't get better than that. It's beautiful.
It was awesome when the younger, taller woman is walking through, and she's like just doing the absolute typical, like, you know, deep breathing, like, like, you know, breathing in the essence of what's going on.
Yeah. The energy, the vibration.
And she's feeling
the actual
energy.
Psychic, I think. I think the other is just her companion or friend or something like
her
that.
Sidekick.
Psychic sidekick. Yeah.
But while I'm watching it, you know, she's actually having some type of experience, and whether she's forcing it on herself or she's, you know,
she's prone to that type of thing. I mean, she's feeling something. It seemed kind of legitimate there, but she's doing it to herself. I mean, it's a total, yeah. It's an experience that is brought on by her internal, her internal interpretation of what's going on there.
Mental masturbation.
Exactly. Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
Well, Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy?
Last week's Who's That Noisy? Here we go.
Okay, Evan, can I take a guess?
Yes.
Is it a very short part of this audio?
Okay, that's enough. That's good.
You can never just listen to it once. Wait.
My God.
So, Evan, what was that?
That was the laughing of a hyena, actually, yes. Several hyenas.
Really?
Creepy.
Wow. I know.
They are freaky.
Sound...
They are freaky.
Whoa. Wow, that is creepy as hell.
Yeah, it is. Did anybody get that?
What's the context of those noises, yes. though?
What do you mean? Like, what are they laughing at, Bob?
Or how many of them are there, and what are
they doing? No, wait. No, we interpret it as a laugh, but they could, who knows what, what they're really feeling?
Yeah, no, it's not a laugh. It's just
hungry.
Hungry or wanting sex, you know, like all animals.
Yeah, Bob, what the hell do you think is going on?
No, including humans.
I just want to know what the scene was that elicited that noise. You know, what was were they?
They're probably jumping around a corpse of something or some animal they're about to kill.
Dolomedes from the message boards was the first correct guesser.
That was interesting.
It was a good find, yes. Now, all right, for this one, you might have to turn your speakers or your headsets up a little bit in order to hear this. The listeners are probably going to have to go back and listen to that a couple of different times.
If you didn't hear anything, you probably need something with more bass. Because it's a very, very low-frequency sound that we were hearing.
Yeah, low-frequency. But, well, let's just say it's unique. And that's the only hint I'm giving. Hmm. And that's enough.
That's cool.
So is it very
good
unique?
Good luck, everyone. Yes.
Incredibly unique?
Yeah, you stop trolling our listeners, please.
Okay. Well, thanks, Evan.
You're welcome.
Well, let's go on with our interview. Well, we're here at TEM 8. We're sitting now with Ben Radford from the Skeptical Inquirer. Ben, welcome
hey there.
Back. And
thank
of
you.
Course, Joe Nickel, who we've had on the show many times before. Joe, always a pleasure.
I remember some of those occasions.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And Karen Stalsnow, who is a contributing editor for the Skeptical Inquirer.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So the reason why we have the three of you on together, because we can talk about anything you want, but we were hoping to talk a little bit about skeptical investigations. Which you all have some experience with. So, Joe,
I've been thinking about beginning that.
Beginning that, yeah.
Starting to do some of that.
Yeah, I mean, you're an icon, obviously, within the skeptical community.
I've been sitting in my computer terminal too long living a virtual life, and I've decided I should get out more.
So. Got to get out there, Joe.
So, why don't we start by just telling us what investigations do you have going on now?
I don't usually like to talk about things in progress. Unfortunately, I've had people try to intervene or one-up me or call and alert someone. It's astonishing that people would do that, but they have.
Well, what about recently concluded?
I can tell you one. I think this one's safe. The War of the Worlds with Orson Welles. Mm-hmm. I got onto through an artist who was doing sort of the art of the hoax and everything. He made me aware of an incident at Grover's Mill, you know, that's where Orson set the actual Martian landing, was at a little place in New Jersey called Grover's Mill. The story is that some folk there got so excited about the Martians landing and so forth that they went out with their guns to defend the town, and mistaking for one of these long-legged Martian machines, mistaking the local water tower, shot it up. and so forth. Well, it's a charming story, as some skeptics might be quick to think, yeah, those folks out there are really stupid and they probably did that. But if you stop and think, it's very unlikely people would shoot up a tower that they grew up with and had lived around all the time and mistake it. So I began to look into this. I've now been to Grover's Mill, and I've got about 8 versions of the story, right, from least to most, and finally tracked down a newspaper. I had to go to a lot of trouble because it's not readily available, and I had to pay to have, you know, a copy gotten, but I found the original version that this never happened. One old guy went out and the next day and stood with his gun to sort of show how he would have defended the place or something, and, yeah, and that picture, you know, yeah, people remembered that, and then wags started saying, oh, he probably shot at it, and then pretty soon it's like several people went out in a group and shot it full of holes, shot it to pieces, versions like that. So you can just watch, that's folklore at work, and I'm working with that. I'm going to do something with it.
Cool. Right. But it shows that you need to go back to primary sources, right? Because once the folklore process takes hold, which just happens, is just what people do, right?
That absolutely.
All the secondary sources are going to be wrong and exaggerated, and although they maybe tell the story of how the folklore evolved over time.
Yeah. I think I've told you before my first big case at McKenzie House with the going on site. And after I found the source of the footsteps on the stairs and explained the case, that made a believer out of me that this is what you do. You must go on site. You must actually investigate theories and so forth that are elsewhere, where there were some obvious things you could use to explain away the phenomena. They were wrong. You had to actually go on site. And I thought, this is what you do. You do this, and people will believe you, and they will love you for it. Of course, I was very mistaken. But I'm still sure that that's the way to do it. And going on site, actually out in the field, doing the experiment, making the giant Nazca drawing, catching the ghost prankster, catching him red-handed, faking the phenomena, that sort of thing. That can only happen if you have a real life rather than a virtual one.
Right, right, right.
So I don't have – I was lying earlier about having a computer.
Right. That's why all my emails bounce, right? Is that what?
That's right. Right. Yeah, your telepathic messages are getting through.
Oh, good. Thank goodness.
Excellent.
And I wish you would clean them up a little.
Sorry about that.
Joe, what was the most red-handed you caught somebody?
Oh, well, certainly 2 come to mind. One at the Haunted Hand Hotel in Fairplay, Colorado, an old mining town up in the Rockies. And I was there accompanying a group of high school students and their teacher, and we spent the night in the hotel. We were collecting. They were running around. The kids were getting my ghost questionnaires filled out and so forth. And we were gathered in the lobby waiting, getting together the group to go out for dinner, and the chandelier lights. This place had great ambiance, you know, bear skins and so forth. And the light was flickering mysteriously. And I just happened to be looking the right direction, and I saw the desk clerk flicking the light. And the teacher also saw him, so it wasn't just my word. And we stared at him, and he went sort of gesturing like, oh, well. You know, so we caught one.
So, Ben, the PSYCOP, or the Committee for the Scientific Investigation and Claims of the Paranormal, is now the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. The word investigation has been removed from the title. But CSI and the Skeptical Inquirer still does, as Joe recommends, in the field, you know, firsthand investigations, correct? And is that the plan?
Absolutely.
To continue that tradition and maybe expand it?
I would certainly hope so. I mean, that's certainly one of my interests, both from working with Joe and my own stuff. So, I mean, I've always felt that, that there's the skepticism has a broad umbrella, and there's room for everything. I mean, you know, alt-med, I mean, just, you know, energy. There's so many fields out there that need to have a skeptical view taken on them. But certainly the investigation aspect of it, there's really only very few of us compared to the stuff that's out there that you know, people are doing that. And so, I've always felt that was very important to do, because otherwise, I mean, I was talking to Dan Loxton the other day, and he's saying, well, if we don't do it, who's going to do it?
Right.
And, you know, Consumer Reports isn't going to do these investigations. Yeah. So I think that it's a vital function that we do. And, And we're, again, you know, just in terms of the skeptical organizations, I mean, Michael Shermer's Skeptic Society, they have a couple people, but for the most part, it's just, you know, CSI in large part.
Right, right. And my sense is that as a movement, we don't do enough for canned investigations. And do you agree with that, first of all? And if so, what should we do about it?
Yeah, I think that we need definitely need to have more investigations of all stripes. In fact, that was one of the reasons that I my new book, Scientific Paranormal Investigation, I sort of wrote that in order to sort of show people a lot of the work that Randy's done and Joe's done that I'm doing and other people as well. To sort of not demystify it, but just sort of say, look, this is not. It is accessible to you if you do the background, if you do the research, if you understand the concepts, and if you take the time to learn good investigative strategies.
Right.
That you know this is something that can be done and should be done. So I think it's vitally important.
Yeah, you don't need a PhD to do reasonable investigations.
Right.
As long as you take a thoughtful approach and. Have to battle, you know, right, Joe? Just being there, just physically being there, observing what's going on.
Yes, some investigations, like a lot of haunted house cases, can be handled by just anybody willing to go there and kind of check the facts and see if things happen the way they are claimed to. I did the most haunted house in America, which is the Myrtle's Plantation. So they say, you see.
Right, well, yes.
And I got Discovery Channel.
It's one of the most haunted. They're all the most haunted.
That's right.
No, actually, yeah, we happen to know it's actually Ed Warren's basement is the most haunted place.
Yes. Well, you guys have done investigations as well. But I was there and courtesy of Discovery Channel and spent the night. And it's I later did historical research and showed that this story of this slave woman named Chloe who poisoned the family and therefore the ghosts or, you know, and so forth has just never happened.
Yeah.
And, but it hasn't apparently stopped the ghost hunters from going there and making fools of themselves again. And
I think there are more believers who are doing investigations than skeptics. Mm-hmm. Far
yeah.
more.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Karen. I think that
they have their own shows.
Yeah. I mean, they have their own shows. Yes. There's a cottage industry of, gullible investigators, if you will. I mean,
we have to run around putting out fires and doing their work for them.
It seems proportional to the amount of people who believe these things versus the amount of people who take a critical approach to these things. I think it's exactly proportional, unfortunately.
And one thing, Karen could maybe talk about this, is that these investigations, when you're talking about the people on the other side, we need to sort of put that in quotation marks because the ghost hunters aren't, to my thinking, are not investigating ghosts.
No.
They're mystery mongering. They're seeking to confirm, a failed hypothesis, and they're not using the techniques of investigation.
No. Yeah, they're sensationalizing the stories. And I did a recent investigation into the Stanley Hotel. Do you know? You might have heard of that from The Shining. And we were pretty much went there and were just putting out fires that were lit by the ghost hunters. So they'd set up a lot of. Or created a lot of stories. Mm-hmm. Some were associated with the place already, but moving tables and rocking chairs that would move with no one sitting on them, things like that. So we were going around and replicating all of these incidents and showing that they could happen naturally. There could be natural explanations for these phenomena.
So those two creepy girls weren't real? I mean, you didn't find them?
We weren't investigating the book as such, just all of the stories that have cropped up subsequently.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
We were at an investigation that the Warrens had sent a contingency out to, and I remember sitting in a bedroom about 2 in the morning with the lights off with a group of people, like some of us and some of the Warrens people. And the guy, one of the Warrens guys was sitting there and literally going, I'm seeing ghosts. You know, I see lights dancing in front of the closet. And he was like describing us like these ghost globules or whatever.
Globules.
And, you know, we're just sitting there and like, of course, you know, we didn't say it, but we, of course, know. No, you're not. Like, this is total bullshit. You're lying. And that's what they do.
Was a psychic?
No, I mean, these were paranormal investigators that were in Ed and Lorraine Warren's group of people.
At that time.
At the time.
Rapidly evolving set of people that were buzzing around Ed and Lorraine Warren, yeah.
I mean, it's almost worse than the guy flicking the light switch, you know.
Yes, it is worse. It is worse. I mean, the guy flicking the light switch was, having some fun with high school students. And so on. But the Warrens, I mean, I knew Ed Warren, and I can tell you that he's one of the most unsavory characters I've ever met. We were on the Sally Jesse Raphael show, and he swore like a sailor back behind behind the scenes, and he leaned over and kind of threatened me and so forth. He just a kind of bullying.
He was a crass man.
Yeah. Crass and bullying man. I did walk down to the limo that was taking him back to the airport. He was sitting in the limo, and I walked up and I said, because, I'm a fighter.
Yeah.
And so I walked up and I said, you were going to do something with me? And he looked all nervous and everything. And I said, Ed, you're a really tough guy. I said, you're just tough right around the mouth.
Yeah.
And turned around and walked off. And the people, of course, I was never invited back to that show, but that's all
right. Right, yeah.
That's okay.
That's an awesome show.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
So, Karen, in different parts of the world, there's different levels of popularity of the various paranormal claims. So, like in Connecticut, in New England, where we're from, it's ghost hunting. I mean, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a ghost hunting group.
Yep.
And that are doing their play acting at investigation.
Yes.
So in Australia, what's the main types of things you run into?
Oh, we have everything that you guys have, just on a smaller scale. I think we've got all the same phenomena. Lots of most haunted houses and really the same things going on, just not as much attention paid to them. We don't have the big budgets for TV shows that you have here, so same things are happening.
Do you have reality shows there? Do you have the ghost hunting reality shows?
Actually, there are some. They've been brought to my attention recently, and they're as lame as the ones here.
Yeah, where nothing actually happens.
And places which are reputed to be terribly haunted, and I've never heard of them before. So I've been doing my research for years, for 14 years now, and I've never heard of these places. So I think they're just wanting to pay off the mortgages.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Lots of cryptozoology going on in Australia, at least that I find.
Yes, and once again, we've got our version of the Sasquatch is the Yowie, and we've got drop bears instead of tree alligators. So same things again, just different names.
I was down under a few years ago, and I investigated, just as she's saying, some of those things, Fisher's Ghost, the haunted Hyde Park Barracks, the haunted Melbourne Jail. We looked for the lost mahogany ship. Mm-hmm. Known in legend along the shipwreck coast of at Warrnambool. But we went into the Blue Mountains looking for the Yowie, and I recommend that. Just if you ever have a chance to do that, go do that. I doubt you'll find the Yowie or anything remotely looking like the Yowie, but I could be
beautiful.
Wrong. I could be wrong. But you will see some just stunningly beautiful countryside and Jenolan Caves.
Is that near Sydney?
It's about 2 hours west of Sydney.
That's not too bad.
Doable.
That's very
doable. It's a day
trip.
Doable. Yeah. Yes.
And the stories that you've cited, those are the classic ones that I know very well. But yeah, lots of new ones which are cropping up of late.
Yes, and I hope to get back
nowhere.
Soon.
Do you guys have a favorite kind of debunking?
Oh, don't use that word.
Favorite or debunking?
Debunking? Well, I don't.
By favorite kind, you mean what?
Like if you're going to go to an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
What kind do you like the best?
Like ghosts versus UFOs versus Sasquatch, that kind of thing?
Well, in my particular case, I find the ghost ones to be most interesting because oftentimes they come down to psychology, and I have a degree in psychology, and so I can often bring that to bear. And so if I'm talking to people, it's after a while, ultimately, as you know, for ghosts, there's not a lot of hard evidence. I mean, they can give you all the orb photos and all the EVPs you want, but ultimately, most of these come down to someone saying, I experienced something weird, and then, this is what it is. And oftentimes, it's interesting because for me, it's more personal. There's more of a chance to help people, to actually help people. I mean, if someone sees a UFO, whatever, they saw UFO, but if people believe there's ghosts in their house, that's very personal for them. As you guys know, I mean, you guys have done this. For me, I think ghost investigations are some of the most interesting just because there's such a wide variety of claims surrounding them. But also, for me, it's more of an opportunity to sort of be interactive person on person and genuinely help people instead of just sort of like, that's a bullshit, Bigfoot photo.
Well, we found, you can tell us if your experience is similar, that half the time we're not so much investigating the claim as investigating the investigators, right? Mm-hmm. We're there to watch what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, because they're the ones who are actually, if anything, manufacturing or greatly magnifying what little, phenomenon has been there. Is that your experience as well?
To go back to the Stanley Hotel, there was an episode of Ghost Hunters where the guys were just sitting around in the dark, filming in the dark, so you couldn't see very much anyway. All of a sudden, the table moves, and they're all incredibly frightened, and it happened several times. And so we went back there to replicate that, to show that you can do this under normal circumstances and with a natural explanation. So a lot of the stories are being generated by these groups, and they go to these places, and of course they're filming for hours and hours and nothing's happening. They need to come up with a story. They need to sensationalize it. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden things are taking place, and they're orchestrating them.
Yeah, I'm sure that the stories grow because they went there.
Oh, they become embellished. They embellish the stories, and that's part and parcel of folklore. But a lot of these are created for the sake of publicity.
Reason I disparage the term debunking is because investigation is something different. Investigation means that you impartially are going to find the truth. We would resent if we had a crime scene, if the sergeant came running in and said, Lieutenant, there's been a shooting. And the lieutenant said, oh, it's probably just another suicide. Put it down as a suicide. And the guy would say, no, he's been shot 3 times in the back. And the lieutenant would say, well, it's a very bad case of suicide. I've seen that kind of armchair debunking, you know, from a distance, and it is just debunking. It is not investigation. I say that as a former detective who's investigated homicides. And
Joe, is there anything you haven't done, by the way?
Yes, and it's a long list. Most of them are dangerous.
Okay.
Juggling is one of them.
Juggling is one, yes. I had to be laughed at. Well, it keeps me humble because I'm always being an amateur trying something different. Right.
That makes perfect sense. I totally get what you're saying. I mean,
I've spent now over 40 years, and you could say, but you've debunked maybe more cases than any other investigator. I mean, I've got a long track record of having debunked, but I never set out to debunk.
Right.
I was curious as a little boy. I have never lost that. I know there's probably no ghost in the next haunted mansion. But I want to know what's going on.
Right.
I want to know, well, what did you hear, or why do you think there was a ghost? And if it can be explained, as Ben suggested, psychologically, as so often it can. I mean, that's almost always some component of it.
Yeah.
But maybe there was a noise. Maybe there's some phenomenon. And it's through that I've learned, and I think we learn, about ourselves and our natural world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's worth learning. I haven't found a ghost, but I've learned a lot about myself, learned a lot about illusions, about motivations for hoaxing, and Steve, you know this, the waking dream phenomenon, which is just powerful.
There's always something going on. It's not the obvious paranormal explanation that some people want you to believe, but there's something going on, and that's worth figuring
out. It's worth doing.
The word debunking, I think that people just misapply it. I think it does not apply to an investigation because you, as you say, you're investigating, and you shouldn't be going in with any kind of bias or presupposed notions. But you don't really debunk a phenomenon. You investigate a phenomenon, but you can't debunk an argument. If somebody makes a bad argument, is why that argument is bunk.
Sure,
right?
You can.
So
sure
I think people use the term loosely, and it may lead to some confusion.
But I'm convinced of this. This is a principle that I hold dear, and that is that if we do good investigative work, that is, if we go on site and we're impartial and looking for the evidence and evidence-based and let the evidence lead to an answer rather than the other way around, if we do that, any needed debunking will take care of itself. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to intend to debunk. You're just confident. If I can explain this, if the rocking chair, and I was laughing because I've had several, the moving rocking chairs, is a very common phenomenon. And I've seen it, everything from someone stepping on a floorboard and causing the rocking chair over there to move, a rickety place, or even once a woman wearing an antebellum skirt, with a hoop skirt, she walked by a rocker, and unintentionally, her hoop way out here from her ankle, whacked the runner. So that she walked by, and I looked over at the rocker, and there was the rocker set in motion. Mm-hmm. It took me a moment to realize what just happened.
Mm-hmm. We tested it with toilet paper, so we had some streaming down from the chair, and were filming it, and could see that the paper was moving and the chair was rocking. And so we found that now toilet paper is an investigative tool. Ghost hunting.
So there was wind moving in there?
Yes, wind was moving it, and it was in the middle of winter too, so you had a lot of wind around, and not a terribly interesting story when you really think about it. It's quite mundane, but I was going to just comment about debunking. I think debunking is the result. It's not the action. You don't set out to debunk. You're investigating.
Exactly.
And as a result, if you can solve or disprove the claims, then you've debunked the story. Mm-hmm. So.
On the ghost hunter specifically, I mean, I talk about that in chapter four of my book. I actually have basically an entire chapter on how not to do investigations. And to my mind, either the ghost hunters, either they are incompetent, that is, they don't know what they're doing, or they're being deceptive. Right. I don't know which it is. I honestly, I can't read their minds, but I mean, there's no excuse in 2010 or in the last 10 years to be doing so-called scientific investigation. And in the book, they talk about, they say in one of their books I have right there. So there's a four paragraph chapter out of 276 pages on science. And now, do they just simply not know what they're doing, or do they know what they're doing and they're intentionally not? I don't know, but either way, it doesn't make them look good.
And it's not necessarily either or. It could be a little bit of both going on there.
Yes, it could be. People are more complicated than either or.
Right. Sure. And I've come to the opinion that it functionally doesn't matter because the behavior is indistinguishable. Right. Whether you are a believer or
that's
pious fraud or your due diligence is so horrible, your methodology is horrible, or you just don't care.
Right.
At the end of the day, it's functionally the same,
right? But people they want to know. All right, how much should I dislike this person? And then the answer determines how you're going to really feel about that person, whether they're being deceptive or they're just self deluded.
I think we could say though, the majority of the ghost hunter TV shows, I hear so many stories about like the cameraman like talking to a friend or whatever, like rumors or whatever. I don't know how true this is, but I hear a lot of things like, oh, my friend knows one of the cameramen on that show, and they like everybody knows it's total BS. Mm-hmm. You know, they're making money. It's a TV show. Like they're there producing a show and creating a TV show. They're not there doing an investigation with a camera crew following them around. The hosts are part of the production of the show. Yeah. I'll say it. I don't know if you guys, I don't care if you don't want to say it. I would say 99% of those people that get involved in those TV shows eventually become just TV producers that produce their show and make the content.
Maybe those are the
show.
Ones that rise to the top. You have to be a little cynical. Well, sometimes we have information, like I know with Sylvia Brown. You know, we have reports from one of her ex-husbands that she made comments that would lead you to believe she doesn't believe a word that she says.
Yeah.
But for a lot of the rank and file, we don't know. We don't have that.
Or Lamarckine, who wrote the Psychic Mafia. I mean, you know, talking about the tricks of the trade.
Well, guys, this has been awesome. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys. Thanks for spending some time with us at TAM.
Good to talk to you guys.
Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Ooh.
This is a back-to-school theme.
I love that movie.
Oh. We're going to talk about the science and fiction of study habits. And there are four items.
Not fair.
Oh, come on.
Although
really?
Still, three are true and one is false. Okay?
All right.
Here we go.
All right. Well.
Item number one. After studying material, self-testing is more effective at enhancing learning than repeated studying. Item number two. It is best to study in a consistent and uncluttered environment. All right, number three, a recent review concludes that there is no evidence to support the notion that different people benefit from different learning styles, such as visual or auditory. And number four, it is better to study a topic spaced out and mixed with other topics than all at once. Jay, go first.
Self-testing is more effective at enhancing learning than repeated studying. I totally agree with that through my own personal experience. The second one is it best to study in a consistent and uncluttered environment? That's interesting. I wonder why. I mean, maybe if your environment is more organized, you're less distracted, perhaps? I don't know. That's interesting. The third one, the review concludes that there is no evidence to support the notion that different people benefit from different learning styles, such as visual versus auditory. I don't know about that. And the final one, it's better to study a topic spaced out and mixed with other topics than all at once. Well, I can agree with that one, too, because the variation and the time where you're not thinking about a particular topic and you're focusing on something else, your brain is processing while you change your attention to something else. So I'm going to say that the third one, the one about the benefiting from different learning styles, is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Self-testing more effective than repeated studying. At first glance, my reaction was that repeated studying would be better. I mean, I just figured that's how people learn, by repeatedly going over the same thing. But self-testing, now that I think about it, self-testing seems like it could be more effective, because you're actually testing your recall. You're not just working on, you know, creating these long-term memories. You're really just trying to pull them up and see how well you've consolidated them. So I'm going to go with that one. Let's see. I'm going to go to the third one here. Yeah, the learning styles. Yeah, that one, I can kind of get behind this one as well, because it seems to me that learning style is more of a human thing and not a personality thing. I would think that there's really a really good way to learn, in other ways that just aren't as good as others, regardless of what personal style you might have. So that one kind of makes sense to me too. The fourth one, mixing your topic with other topics, is better. That kind of makes sense as well to me, because by doing the same thing over and over, your mind becomes kind of inured to it, and you're just not benefiting as much as if you mix it up. So I'm going to say that the second one, that it's best to study in a consistent and uncluttered environment. I'm going to say that one's false, for the similar reasoning that I used for this last one, the fourth one. So I'm going to say the studying in a consistent and uncluttered environment is the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Bob makes a good point. I agree that self-testing is more effective than repeated studying. That makes sense to me and jibes with my past experiences studying. Forces your brain to kind of think of the topics from a different angle, I suppose. But yeah, that's always helped me. You know, the idea that there's no evidence for the idea that different people benefit from different learning styles, that's the most controversial thing in this list. But that leads me to think that it's true, because it seems like the obvious choice. But because I'm not aware of that recent review. But it's a trap. It's a trap.
It's a trap.
It's a trap. It's a trap.
I wasn't going to go with the obvious, but yeah, I was actually going to do the voice and everything. But I'm glad you guys were there to do it for me.
We all did it too.
No problem.
That's
even good.
Funnier.
Now say
he's dead, Jim.
No, I won't. Yeah, and yeah, I agree that it's better to cramming doesn't work well. You know, just studying one thing right before you take the test. It's much better to study it interspersed with other things. At least that's how my brain seems to work. If I leave a problem alone and come back to it later, it's easier to solve. I think it's the same kind of thing. So yeah, that leaves me with the idea of studying in a consistent, uncluttered environment. I think that I may want to say that, you know, uncluttered is better and cleaner and allows you to focus. I think that varying your, like Bob said, varying your habits, it forces your brain to make more connections, I suppose, and learn the material a bit better in that way. So I think that one's the fiction as well.
All right, Evan?
I'll get right to the point. Best to study in a consistent and uncluttered environment is the fiction. That was to the point, right?
Okay. You're going to go with Bob and Rebecca?
GWBR.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that, but I'm saying that one's the fiction.
Okay. Well, then let's take these in order. We'll start with number one. After studying material, self-testing is more effective at enhancing learning than repeated studying. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Hooray.
Yeah, not too surprising. And the concept there is the notion of desirable difficulty, that making your brain work hard actually creates more of a lasting memory. Forcing yourself to, as you say, Bob, to dredge up the information is better than just looking at it again. Now, certainly repetition is also important for studying, but you have to do it in a way that makes your brain actually work hard, right? So testing, despite the fact that it often does not have a great reputation in education, it's too rigid, people are going to teach towards the test, etc. But testing actually is a very effective way to teach and to learn.
Wait, can I just say before we get emails that the teaching to the test thing is about standardized tests across the board and not a problem with tests in general.
Right. So, no, I agree. I think that people think that testing itself has a bad reputation because of those kinds of reasons.
Right.
Right. I agree.
Just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, it's a distinct point. It is best to study in a consistent and uncluttered environment. Everyone but Jay thinks that one is the fiction. Jay, you think that one is science. And that one is the fiction.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Good job, guys. And you guys are pretty
Sorry, Jay,
on target. Studies going back actually to 1978, various studies show that studying in different locations is advantageous, that subjects would retain more of the information they studied just by varying the environment, the location where they study. And the thinking is, as Rebecca said, that when we're learning, we associate our memories of what we're learning with other stimuli around us. And by varying your environment, it sort of forces the brain to make more connections with different things, even though they're completely incidental to the material itself. It just enhances the whole process of forming memories. And, you know, cluttered versus uncluttered. In fact, you have a cluttered environment, that just gives you more things to associate what you're learning with, right? There's no advantage to an uncluttered environment. And so, it's actually just a wives' tale, the notion that you should always study in the same place, like find a consistent location where you do your studying. But there really isn't any advantage to that. You should go outside and study, go into different rooms, different places, you know, mix it up.
I think that idea of having a consistent place comes from the idea of that it's good to have a specific place to work that's separate from, for instance, if you're a teenager, you know, and you study in bed, that can be a problem because bed is for sleeping, and then you might have trouble sleeping because you begin to associate that space with stress and with studying.
Right.
So it's good to have a, you know, separate areas, but not necessarily.
But Steve,
the same place is good.
One thing's confusing to me about this, though. I've read many times that memories are easier to recall if those memories are associated with other memories. And it makes sense that way when you recall one memory, it kind of links you to these other memories. And that makes sense. But linking your studying to the objects in your environment doesn't quite make that much sense to me, because then what does that mean? You've got to recall that apple that was over there to the right in order to help you recall the physics you were learning. I mean, how do those associations actually help?
I don't think it's necessarily a conscious thing that you're using a mnemonic, you know, the stuff in your environment to specifically remember things that you're studying. I think it's just that the subconscious, you know, association that your brain is doing while it's trying to encode new information, it helps that process. You know, it is, you do sort of associate it, even if it is subconsciously, with what you were looking at and what color your environment is and how you felt. All those things get tied up with the material that you're studying. And if there's more different associations, the brain can hold on to that information better.
Mm.
Let's go on. Number three, a recent review concludes that there is no evidence to support the notion that different people benefit from different learning styles, such as visual versus auditory, and that one is science. And I worded that very carefully. There's no evidence to support the notion that different people benefit. So it doesn't necessarily mean that different people may not prefer different learning styles, but there's no advantage to catering to those learning styles. So if you're thinking about designing a course at school, or, you know, a school system deciding, you know, what resources to use, there's no consistent advantage to one teaching style over other teaching styles, or one learning style over other learning styles. If people are it doesn't seem to matter. For example, they commented on the fact that some teachers are just more engaging than others, and it doesn't necessarily have to do with anything specific about their style that could be pinpointed. Some people may be more dynamic and more animated. Other people may be more, you know, sedate and laid back, but they could both be very effective in their own way. So basically do what makes sense, and you don't have to waste, the school systems don't need to waste resources, you know, trying to individualize in that way. Which means that number four, it is better to study a topic spaced out and mixed with other topics than all at once, is also science. So if you have three or four different things to study, rather than like studying math, then studying history, then studying science, you're better studying a little of each and then going back and forth among the different topics. So this also increases the association. Again, you're sort of forcing your brain to jump around to different kinds of topics of information. It also, there's a completely separate advantage So you know, there's one aspect here is the interlacing of different topics, but the other one, which is completely independent, is spacing it out. So rather than studying for 3 hours on one day, you'd be better off studying for an hour each day for 3 days. So that you know, going away from a topic and then coming back to it has more of a reinforcing effect on memory than doing it all at once. So I think that's something that we all, you know, if you've gone through a lot of schooling, you kind of know it's somewhat intuitive. We know that just cramming over a short period of time, although it will help. You know, you can cram a lot of information over a short period of time. It doesn't stick with you for very long. Whereas if you study thing over a longer period of time, if you're disciplined and you study throughout, you know, the semester or whatever, that information sticks with you much better. I didn't make it into a specific question, but there was also research that was looking at a very similar concept, but not with topics, but with ways of looking at different kinds of information. So the specific study was trying to train people to recognize artwork, like a piece of art as being from a specific artist. And the question was, should you show them all examples of that artist's work in a row so that they can sort of see the commonalities among them, or should you show them that piece of art interspersed with other artists? It turns out that the interspersing it with other artists had a better outcome in terms of, you know, memory and task performance at the end.
That sounds suspiciously close to those pseudoscientific Malcolm Gladwell BS studies and Blink, doesn't it?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think the point here is you're forcing people. So in other words, what's better, giving people an optimal opportunity to see the similarities among the different works of art by the same artist, or giving them an opportunity to have to distinguish that from other artists over and over again?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I guess my issue is just that these sort of studies usually seem to be very small scale, and then they get blown up and applied to, you know, the larger world to a degree that's not really appropriate.
I agree. Basically what you're saying is that, yeah, you have a very, very narrow controlled study design, and then you try to extrapolate it to some big sweeping conclusions about how the brain works and how people learn. I agree with that. But in this case, the study designs are carefully reflecting very practical, actual, real-world learning environments, right? It's a lot closer to the application than a lot of the psychological studies, where it's kind of a contrived, artificial situation, and then you have to extrapolate wildly to real life. Here you're talking about, you know, what people should actually be doing when they're studying, or how lesson plans should be organized. So well done, guys. Nice try, Jay.
Thanks. Speaking of which.
Yes. You want to know what your punishment is?
I do.
All right, so I've carefully considered the dozens of responses that I got after asking for more last week. There were some interesting ones. I think some were a little bit labor-intensive. But I thought the most appropriate one was at our next live event, which will be at TAM Australia.
Oh, boy.
You are going to introduce Bob with an appropriate honorific, which I will write. That properly recognizes Bob's superiority in science or fiction.
His superiority to me?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
To me?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is what he proved, right?
Well, then why do you get to write it? Why can't I?
No, well, you feel free to give me suggestions, but I have to approve the final version to make sure that it is adequately obsequious.
And embarrassing.
I approve of that.
All right, I'll do it. I mean, you know,
of course you're
going to
do it.
Like, I don't think Bob is awesome anyway, but sure, I'll do it.
Okay. Make it overwhelmingly obsequious.
Well, of course, that's the whole point.
Not merely adequately.
It'll be like, you guys remember A Fish Called Wanda? You know, I apologize unreservedly.
Unreservedly.
It'll be along those lines.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
All right, fine, I'll do
not
that.
Nearly as embarrassing as I anticipated, but that's okay.
Okay. All right, but Jay, give us a quote this week.
All right, being that this was a funny show, at least the unedited version was very funny.
Are you saying I'm a clown?
We'll see what it's like at the end.
I'm going to read a funny quote by Steve Poliak, P-O-L-Y-A-K.
Poliak.
Poliak. Before we work on artificial intelligence, why don't we do something about natural stupidity?
Can't we work on both at the same time?
Do you guys not like that one?
I do. I like
that. No, that was good. That was good. We're just waiting on the name.
Oh. Yeah. Steve Poliak.
Well done.
Woo. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Shirley.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.